Good evening, you all. K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. We'll also hear Mel, K2 Kilo Echo Yankee. Mel and Dick are the designated net control operators. Try to organize this crew that hosts Sunday evenings at 8 o'clock. Stick around until night or beyond the time. Favorite subject, ham radio. Wireless technology in general. Tech nets are all recorded, and you can play them back by going to the website of amateurradio.tangovictor, www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Temporarily, there's a bit of an error in website where June 19th and July 10th, those dates, the recordings are somewhat blank, or I'm not quite sure what's going on, but some kind of a correction is required, both June 19th and July. But eventually, that'll be corrected. But other than that, there are 6 solid years of TechNet recorded there that a person can play back. Those who check into the LIMOC website, LIMOC.org, I think it is, www.LIMARC.org, you'll eventually find ways that you can be talking to the TechNet by, there's a streaming technique, there's an Echo Link way, there's an IRLP way, there's quite a few different ways that people out of the area can sign into the TechNet. Let me drop, or at least listen to it if not sign in. Majority of the people who do sign into the TechNet are from the state area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. Peter has moderately good coverage of those areas. There's a lot of brain power in that area, and we try to tap into that brain power. Guarantee you're going to see 100% accuracy of all of the subjects that are discussed. There are quite often some errors that get corrected downrange when someone reviews what was said and gives us the correcting information. But at least it's a sincere effort to be accurate. Questions that are asked on the TechNet, there's no such thing as a dumb question. Don't worry about that. Mel and Dick make a pretty strong effort to treat everyone with dignity. A dumb question is a question really by a person who has a bigger gap between what he knows and what he would like to know. Think about it. That's really the answer. That's really the question that's most deserving of an answer. He's got a longer way to go. He's come here to find out, and we're going to try to help him. First hour of the TechNet is dedicated to early ham radio subjects, and we make a sincere effort to of all the people who sign in the beginning of the first hour, we try to give them at least a brief answer during the first hour. In other words, in theory, no one has to wait more than an hour, even though the TechNet waits less for quite often 4 hours beyond. The person usually doesn't have to wait more than 1 hour to get at least a preliminary answer. At approximately 9 o'clock, Mel goes to the mailbag. We're getting amateurs who don't yet have a license on the job. There are people who find the TechNet on their scanner, Echo Link, or IRLP, or website, and decide that these people are having a good time. They're involved in a rather educational hobby, and they want to join them. So those people will quite often send emails and snail mail to Mel, K2KEY, and Mel will select some of those that we think are most appropriate, and at 9 o'clock we handle a few of those. Beyond that, if something interesting is happening in space, call WS2N on Space Expert. Tells us what's going on. Beyond those three items that I just mentioned, we then go into the deeper subjects. Wesley has given us a significant list of things that we're probably not going to be able to answer them all, go through them all. But for those who want to know a little bit closer to the molecular level or the atomic level, what is taking place, how do radio waves really get created and propagated, what is resonance and heat, and so on. So closer to information, laboratory-like information, to that into the later hours. So you've had forewarning as to what kind of subject is going to be discussed when. There's always a group of people who think that the deeper subject should not be discussed. And what they're really saying is that they want control of only their favorite subject to be discussed and no other subject. Think about it, though, you realize that how an organization, a society, or a person progresses display curiosity. Curiosity in many cases is somewhat unbounded. Whatever you're curious about, as long as you're hurting anybody in the process, I think it should be pursued. Whereas quite often serendipity strikes. In other words, didn't expect to get a benefit. It's a pretty random subject, and all of a sudden you start seeing a relationship. Mother Nature has created an awful lot of relationships with various kinds of technology. So those people with that curiosity subject, they take place at the later hours of the TechNet. The person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, word yes, which means you you have a question or a comment to the net. After 28 years, this is 1,359 of the series that began in September of 1982. After 28 and a half years, Mel, Dick, and other people believe that there are people listening. It doesn't have to be confirmed to us. We don't need a long list of people saying that I'm here. Don't have a question. So most of the sign-ins should be the people who really have a question or a comment, and they do that by giving us their call letters, followed by their name, followed by the word yes. Now we have double assurance that they should go on the list of people who really have a question. So please give me your call letters and name at this time. KQRIW listening.
YY. Joe.
Yes.
Okay, the ISK, we heard Jay and Joe. ISK, give me your full call letters, Jay.
YSK, quick question.
Okay, YSK. Joe? QRYY. Alrighty. We got those two so far. Who else would like to sign into the TechNet with a question or comment? Please give me your call letters and name and the word yes right now.
Care
of that.
Okay, is there another person checking in besides Jay and Joe? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
WS Glenn, Paul with the space topic. Good evening, Dick.
Okay, glad to hear that, Paul. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name at this time. Okay, we heard Mel. Go right ahead, Mel.
I've got many email or LP or Echo. Was it not long enough to get bring you up?
I hear you, Mel. Okay. At this time, we're going to give a nice, long pause for people who are out of the area who wish to sign in, who are about to give me their call letters, their and the word yes, which means they do really have a question or a comment. Here comes the long pause right now. Okay, that was a nice long call for NY2H. That was Lou. Anyone else out of area who wants to check in? We're going to give another nice long pause for people out of area who are checking in by way of Echo Link, IRLP, or what have you. Give your call letters and name right now. KQRIW in the TechNet.
I think your IRLP node dropped you off the reflector because you're not coming out of the East routine.
KQRIW.
Okay, this is KQRIW, and I heard WGB did something with the programming of my machine. Stand by a second. Yeah, now I got it back to the normal programming. Okay, so far we've got Jay, Joe, Boo. I think that's the correct order. If not, I'll be corrected real soon. And Paul has a space report. So, one last call, one last long pause in case anyone out of area by way of IRLP, Echo Link, or whatever wants to check in. Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
K2RIW, you might want to give K2KE a call and ask them to reconnect your repeater node back to the Echo to the reflector because you're not connected to the door.
Yeah, I just did a test of transmitting on the Eastern Link. Unfortunately, the Eastern Link seems not to be connected. So, if anyone knows how to get a hold of either KE2EJ or WA2CEL or K2L, have command capability on the machine, request that they reconnect the Eastern Link so that the Echo Link and other modes have the capability. After we answer one or two of the questions, we'll go back and give another long pause and see if we can pick up those people. Okay, Jay, you claim you have a quick question. Don't worry about it. It doesn't have to be quick. K2YSK, K2RIW. You got it, Jay.
Masha Moran, use it.
When it gets back to you, Jay, tell us that that's a canary we're hearing in the background. Very pleasant sounding bird. Yeah, the leaves, particularly leaves that are wet, definitely absorb some RF. The big question now is how much? On frequencies of VHF, upper VHF and UHF, like 432 and 1296, your antenna is below tree line. And if you're transmitting more than in a direction that where you have to go through more than a couple of trees, you're going to suffer a significant amount of loss. My early days on 432, I used to keep records about what signal strength in microvolts. I had calibrated my...
Is this WHCDL, are you copy?
Yes, we are copy.
Stand by for a second. Just stop the jet. I want to reset this controller and see if I can establish a connection to the east input. Is that okay with you? Would you mind?
That's the right thing to do. Go right ahead, Andy.
All right, thank you.
I think we're not because I'm hearing no connection between east and west. My guess is he's still working on it.
Talking about me, Jeff. You are currently
auto connect heading.
K2RIWWHCDM.
Go right ahead, Andy. I heard 375 said it connected to 9126. I heard 85 say it's connected, but I'm hearing no communication between the two. Looks like the link is a little troublesome tonight. Is that true, Andy? Go ahead.
That's what it appears to be, because we're both connected on both ends. So continue the net, and we'll have to see what's going on with the link itself. It should automatically connect. There's an auto connect, and it's not working. It usually takes about a minute, but it's not doing it.
Okay, I guess what we're going to do is just continue and break in when you tell us that we should give a nice long pause because the people out of area will be able to get through. With Jay's question, how much attenuation do you get from trees? Trees definitely create attenuation, but now the big variable is how much. It is my guess that as the frequency you're using goes high enough, and that the wavelengths are short enough, so that the wavelength starts approaching diameter of the leads. My belief that that's one of the mechanisms by which the loss increases considerably. As I was mentioning earlier, 10, 15, 20 years ago, when I was getting very interested in 432 around the time that I was using that parallel kilowatt amplifier, strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier in 432, a USC article, and quite a few people have built that transmitter, I had calibrated my receiver system in microvolts, so lots of people in the area keep a card file about 460 different guys on 432, and periodically they would make some kind of a change to their antenna system, altitude, number of elements, whatever, when we drop, and they'd hook up with me on the air on 432 and say, hey Dick, how's my signal tonight? If you 15 microvolts, what is it doing tonight at your QTH? So by keeping those records, people could find out as they made improvements to their system, more transmit power, higher antenna gain, higher altitude of the antenna itself, bigger tower, and so on. They were getting a quantitative answer, and so for those reasons, I was somewhat popular at that time. What I did notice is that for the guys who have an antenna on 432 that's below the top of the tree line, wintertime they sounded pretty good. In the summertime, their signal was a healthy 10 or 15 dB weaker, and on a rainy day when there's wet leaves on 432 and the antenna is below the tree line, they would sometimes get as much as 20 decibels weaker. As you go down to lower frequencies like 2 meters and 6 meters, the phenomena I'm describing decreases. Doesn't disappear, but gets lower. By the time you get down to 40 meters and 20 meters, where your wavelengths are now starting to be numbered like 100 feet or so, and the leaves on the trees are only a few inches diameter, the rate at which you get attenuation slowly goes down, in my opinion. As you go down in frequency, the trees are giving you less attenuation. But there's a couple of catches here. Let me drop. Your particular antenna sit in such an environment that in order to get that signal out to the earth, out to the ionosphere, you've got to go through a mile of trees. Even on a low frequency, you're going to suffer some loss. Well, since most of our antennas, on most of the HF frequency, horizontally polarized antennas, typically have takeoff angles like 20 and 30 degrees, unless you're living on the side of a hill, where the hill in that direction where it has a slope of 20 degrees and there's trees on it all the way. Other than that, you're not going to be transmitting through miles of trees. So if you look at the real elevation angle, the function of how high your antenna is on the ground, and go a straight line from the antenna through the trees at that elevation angle, you can easily calculate how many trees you've got to go through before the signal really gets out into free space and can get up to that ionosphere. The bottom line of all that is that the biggest impact you're going to be getting on HF frequencies from leaf trees is a very minor amount of detuning. may have set the dipole antenna, the fan dipole, that particular band length of the wire, such that in truly free space, it should have 16 feet long on 10 meters, and because your dipole is coming very close to a tree branch, a little bit of extra capacitive loading, therefore you're building up a little bit of standing wave ratio, and if you shortened it a little bit, you bring it back into resonance in the presence of the capacitance of the tree. So on HF, I think the trees are fairly minor, but maybe some of you guys out there have got more hands-on experience. Let me test it over to Mel for a quick one on that one. I bet you your guys would do all these shootouts and tests with various kinds of antennas and whatever. I bet you your guys have come up with some opinions as to how much radio attenuation you get on HF frequencies on something like a fan dipole at a reasonable altitude. So I wonder what kind of experience your guys have had on that one, Mel. K2KEY, you might want to wait for the whole advertisement to go by. K2LIW is the TechNet. I wonder if Mel is on frequency. One more call. K2KEY, are you there, Mel? K2LIW? Maybe he got called away. Is there anyone else who has really run some experiments with the that would lead them to believe how much foliage attenuation they're getting on HF frequencies, maybe versus VHF frequencies? You got some experience in that area? Please give me your call letters right now. KQRI, good to be listening.
WS2S.
Go right ahead, Paul.
I remember asking the same question about 5 years, 5 or 6 years ago on that about the trees, but in particular, dealing with 2 meters, your prediction at the time was, as now, you're not going to see much of a change. I've been on a Connecticut net, a Connecticut simplex net, probably for the last 10 years, every Thursday at 9 o'clock, 145.505. And we run tests. I mean, that's just, it's a simplex net, and you test your amplifiers, you test your antennas, some new changes or whatever. So in my case, that particular time, there was two gigantic oak trees. Oh, they were maybe 30 feet, one of them, and it was about 30 feet in front of the antenna. The other one, week to week, I just don't see any difference in net meter reports. You know, part of the net is when net meter reports, after years of doing this, you tell whether or not you're pretty much the same from week to week, or it changes from week to week, the propagation. But average over time, there was no difference. Back to you.
WJ2B recognized. Thank you for that report, Paul. I'm amazed that you didn't see any of that tree. WJ2B, go right ahead with your information, sir.
I just have a theory about the... my experience, I found that tree 5 to 10 feet of possible ceiling.
I think you've got a good point there, Joe. As the interfering object gets closer and closer to the antenna, it's going to create more of an impact due to insertion loss, more of an impact due to a multi-tab, more of an impact as it really gets close to the capacitive loading and slightly changing the frequency. When you study something that's called a Rayleigh fading, no, it's not what I'm talking about. Mike, can I think of the name for the technique by which you L zone? When you are trying to do a HF-UHF link, let's say, for instance, between two buildings, between two mountains or whatever, establishing a fixed communication link known point, have various objects that might be creating a problem in between points. The first of all world, you'd have two very high mountains with a deep valley in between, indicating between signals, sending signals with some parabolic dish antennas between those two mountains. Real world, you're going to have trees, buildings, and all kinds of things. And even though perfect line of sight between the two sites, you look with your binoculars while you're sitting in the middle of the antenna in one site, and you have easy a view of the antenna on the other site on a clear day, and essentially nothing in between. You've assumed that you're going to have 100% reliability. Well, you don't. Because the signal that's being transmitted from the first antenna, 20 degrees, within that 20 degrees beyond the line of sight, down below the line of sight, you're going to be seeing the tops of trees, the tops of water towers, the tops of buildings, and other things, hills and so on. Depending on the extra path length, those other objects, because the signal is hitting those objects, and therefore it's being scattered forward. The signal is hitting those extraneous objects. Once you transmit a signal, it goes to every object in the universe, if you know what I mean. Something you have to discuss is that because of your antenna pattern, how strong is the signal when it hits that object? and some of that signal is reflecting forward off that water tower into the receiving site. At the receiving site, what Mother Nature does is she doesn't add power, she adds voltages. She takes the voltage of each one of those signal paths, calculates their amplitude in volts, phase angle, and adds them together, including the phase angle. That's called a vector addition. A magnitude of volts with phase information, most people will call that a vector. So you add up all those individual vectors, and if that's a composite signal of all of that addition, is above threshold, the receiver is happy. Weather conditions change, atmospheric conditions change, various amplitudes go up and down. There are therefore certain reliability. You may have signals that get there 98% of the time, but the 2% of the time could give you sleep. If it happens to be a link, it has to be guaranteed very high reliability because of the nature of the data being sent over that link. Well, not only whether or not that object has the extra path length, it's called a Fresnel zone, if it's in the odd versus even Fresnel zones, which really means whether or not the signal is in phase or out of phase by the reflection off the multipath object, let me drop. You could worry about whether or not it's in the odd or even Fresnel zone, but another bigger worry is how close. As the multipath object gets closer and closer to an antenna on either side, either the sending end or the receiving end, the object becomes more and more dominant. Sort of see why, because free space loss, free inverse square loss, you get a certain rate of signal fall off from the transmitting antenna to the object. After reflection, you go through the equation all over again, inverse square law from the reflection of the object over to the receiver site. So you get the minimum impact when the reflecting object is midway between the two sites. As the object that's doing the reflection gets closer and closer to one site, going from mid all the way over to one site means that the longest path changed by 2 to 1, that's only 6 dB. But the shortest path changed by half path length versus 0.01 path length, and that's a huge difference in decibels. So part of the two signals that have to be added together for the reflecting object, the outgoing signal from the transmitter to the reflecting object, and then the reflected signal to the receiver, right? Those two paths of the multipath, you have to add those two together in decibels, and you can sort of see mathematically why a reflecting object that's closer and closer to either site becomes more and more dominant. I know we've gone reasonably far off of your original question here, Jay, but I think you're probably, with 98% assurance, losing sleep unnecessarily on this one. At HF frequencies and even as high as 2 meters from what we're hearing, trees are nowhere near as bad as you think. KT2YSK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KT2YSK, quick number.
Very good. Mel's there. Go ahead, Mel. What have the guys at the Kings County Radio Club seen on this particular subject? You got it, Mel.
Carry it here, not too far from me. There's a lot of elements. Well, not too far from the north, the high rise. You notice these two types of buildings going up. In other words, truck pulls up with concrete block slab. During the daytime, the truck is trained a mile away. As it swings out with these wavy beats on, goes back, goes up another one, maybe they back in, and this back and forth all day long. I don't have to wait for how critical time they can be over.
It is my guess that part of the aggravating factor here is the so-called digital television. Good news about digital television is you can squeeze a whole lot of videos and audios in one 6-megacycle bandwidth channel. That's the good news. As long as the signal is above threshold, bit error rate, not necessarily signal to noise ratio, bit error rate, which is a more stringent requirement, you get essentially a snow-free, beautiful picture. But we're all slowly discovering that digital television has got two very serious vulnerabilities. Ignition noise can tear it up pretty fast, and multipath can tear it up pretty fast. You and I did a study, Mel, of those concrete slabs being lifted into position. Amount of signal that they're blocking, fraction of a decibel. The signal that's flowing around those concrete slabs, and as far as the signal strength is concerned, very little is happening. Even if the concrete slab, a quarter of a mile away from you, is directly in the line of sight, that signal will flow around it beautifully as far as signal strength is concerned. But there's another big problem that dropped. Back in the days of analog television, we had a direct path and an indirect path. An indirect path, in this case, is reflecting off of that concrete slab. because of the extra pass length to the concrete slab, you're going to see a picture that has a slight ghost to it. In other words, shifted to the right as a slightly weaker signal. Exact same picture normally, and the whole picture has a another picture that's much, much dimmer, shifted to the right, the so-called ghost image. With analog television, we've seen ghost images for years, particularly when airplanes fly over and whatever. And we've learned to live with them, and they're a rather minor nuisance, minor annoyance. Case of digital television, that ghost image, a little bit delayed in time, and you get these millions of individual digital pulses of the original signal coming to you. Another set of them shifted to the right, and the peaks of one fall into the valleys of the other and create what's called intersymbol distortion. In other words, all of a sudden the ones and zeros are nowhere near as clean as they used to be. Digital converter says, I give up. I can't find out what the hell's going on here. And so, depending on who you talk to, right, I hear numbers like 15 and 12 and 10 and 8 dB of difference between the multipath and the real signal, where the digital converter, depending on the status of your particular digital converter, is it one of the earlier ones or the ones of a much later design, how much can they tolerate? Let me drop. Very fine, Jay. And bye-bye for now. And we'll go on with your subject, and we'll discuss the really juicy parts of how you could have gotten $1 million out of this one. That's the problem, Jay. So, digital television is very much less tolerant because of multiband, inter-symbol distortion, and so on. So, the people with over-the-air television used to be the dominant group who were buying satellite and cable television, used to be sort of a minority. Well, all of a sudden, things started pushing around where people wanted a whole lot of, Cinemax, Showtime, and sports, and whatever. And now, with the disadvantages we have with over-the-air digital television, all of a sudden, we over-the-air people are the second-class citizens. And my goodness, are we suffering. What's your guess as to what percentage of the people in the neighborhood, those who think they can't afford cable, but what percentage do you think are watching over-the-air television? In my particular town, Huntington, the Dix Hill section of Huntington, I think I'm the only person of a town of quite a few thousand people that's watching over-the-air television. How's it in your neighborhood, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Without saying me and you of the old time, how you live with SNR, you between 13, 21, 25, or whatever, or something. That may strike my fancy. Otherwise, weather for the morning, a couple hours a week. In fact, my brother's got the Fios and all that. I'll tell you that out of 279, or 250 of them, I don't think, 37 stations.
Yeah, and where you and I stand, Mel, it's not an economic thing. It's a pride thing. We like getting over-the-air television the way we've always done it. To go out and buy cable, fiber, coaxial cable, or satellite. It just sort of bothers me. And I watch more than enough television as it is, so I don't need the extra attraction. Okay, the next person on the list was Joe, WB2RYY. What's the latest with you, Joe? And any suggestions on how we can solve the linking problem? Joe's got it? B2RYW listening.
WHYY is the call, actually. Solving a linking problem. I'm not sure why your node dropped out. That's what I heard. Your node dropped off the reflector. My question is about circularly polarized transmission today. It's a link to a website, another email with a PDF file. I don't know if you had time to look at it before the technet, but look at that. That's basically what I've asked you a question about. Sort of like opinion. What do you think about that compared to vertically polarized arrays and so forth? Circular, because they claim it's quite a bit of a signal difference between just this vertical polarized type of open bay array.
Yeah, I'm looking at your website right now. Your email address to me, opening up circular polarization PDF, is revisiting circular polarization TV technology. Say that again?
Was it me?
Okay, somebody told me the link is active. The person who said that, I'm hearing them on the input, 146.25. Because they're not transmitting a PL tone, they weren't coming through the machine. So, the link is active. Let me give a quick listen right now. Is there anybody listening to the link? Well, let's let the link work for a little while so that people get a chance to know that we're back in operation. T-Technology, revisiting circular polarization, mobile TV broadcasting, and panel devices, and car top antennas. What is that? At coherent 4FSK. Let's see what that is. Bit error rate. Rayleigh fading channel. Static channel. Okay. I'm getting the impression that this organization claiming that circular polarization has got some hidden benefit. When it comes to multipaths, guarantee that the multipath only had one single bounce. Guarantee that the signal after the bounce clockwise becomes counterclockwise. That's what happens with one bounce on circular polarization. You've got a transmit that's clockwise, you get a receiving antenna that's clockwise. In theory, one single bounce gets partially rejected. So with this multipath vulnerability of digital television, I see a potential advantage for circular polarization. I wonder if that's the main the gist of this particular article, Joe. W-A-E-2-R-Y-Y-C-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
I just briefly scanned over the article on the website, and I didn't really look too much on the PDF file. I just, who sent it to me, I acknowledged that I got it, and I just forwarded it over to you. So, what do you think about it?
I do know that in the past, the broadcast industry has made a number of circular polarization example trials where people wanted to believe that in the marble canyons of a place like New York City, where Jason used to get a whole lot of multipath and a whole lot of ghosting, that circular polarization would give significant advantage. It was a little bit more complicated to make chimney-mounted antenna, the clean circular polarization, a little bit more effort required at the transmitter site to make the antenna circular polarized, but all of that is doable. In the past, with analog television, my impression is, although that experiment has been run once every 10 or 15 years on quite a few occasions, I think they came to the conclusion it's not worth fighting for. But now, once we accept the vulnerability of digital television, I see the possibility of revisiting. So a rather small amount of change of multipath, and because of this very drastic threshold characteristic, let me drop. If you're talking about nothing but pure signal strength, the lowering the signal strength of a digital television signal and watching the screen, we find out that the threshold from pure snow-free picture to nothing at all is approximately 1 decibel. An extremely hard threshold characteristic is what digital television has. In the case of analog television, a snow-free picture would be 47 dB of signal-to-noise ratio, and all the way down to 30 decibel signal-to-noise ratio. The picture was exciting enough, you'd watch it. 17 decibels of change from perfect snow-free all the way down to fairly annoying, but 17 decibels of change was to some degree tolerable with analog television. Digital television, you go from perfect to nothing in a fraction of 1 decibel. As such, even if you're only getting a 1, 2, or 3 decibels of advantage of direct path versus multipath in by way of using circular polarization, because of that hard threshold characteristic of digital, I see the possibility that circular could be worth fighting for. So if Eric is available, I'd like to hear his take on that one, Joe. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, H-U-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Okay. I think these guys are using this more for digital television. I think they're using it for, regular amateur communication. Why I position that's the thing too, yet, as far as length. I think that's what part of what they're talking about. Must be using it in sort of digital fashion, but they're using it more for amateur communication. But I understand what you're saying about for digital TV. One thing you forgot to mention about digital TV, you mentioned two things, but I'll tell you this, there's a third one, there's a hidden one that you don't even think about or realize very much. Maybe it's not that prevalent in the city, but it certainly is prevalent out by me. Kind of summer months when you get band opening up and down the coast, it does not seem to take very much of a co-channel interfering signal to basically knock something off the air from New York City or compete with it very heavily to be able to make the picture pixelate quite easily. That's what I've noticed.
And where you're using a spectrum analyzer, Joe, and you can look at that carrier signal, 304 kilohertz, whatever it is from the low end of the band, 350 kilohertz, but you know where that pilot signal is, therefore have a rough approximation of how strong is the multipath versus the real. You have a gut feel for when we get the long-range propagation, sporadic E or whatever, in the summertime. The ascending signal is 10 or 15 dB weaker than the main Empire State Building signal. Is that about where we start losing the demodulation capability? Over to you, Joe, H-U-R-I-W.
J-C-B.
J2B recognized.
I can't answer that question. I asked you this about the subject a few weeks ago, and I cannot
discern the difference between signals that are very close in frequency, practically on the same frequency within like hertz of each other, up to 30 or 40 hertz. I can't measure the difference between the two signals. I really couldn't tell you what the signal amplitude of one signal compared to the other one is. So then again, I couldn't tell you what the signal difference ratio between the two actually are. I can listen up. It's actually .309.4 below the bottom end of the TV. Listen to it audibly in AM, and I can tell if there's a pitch to. That tells me that there is something else there. It would be either very, very close to frequency or quite a bit removed in frequency between them. Sometimes I found these carriers a casing or more apart between, some are on, .308.4, some are on .309.4, some are on .321.2, .3, something like that. So not all on the same frequency, but it's hard to determine the amplitude of each one to know what it is. I do know, that I was watching Channel 7 WABC from New York. Band opened up and it was so strong, having my antenna pointed at about 290 degrees, and it basically took Channel 7 out from New York City. And sending signal is actually something that they will lock up onto once they turn the antenna 220 degrees from Baltimore.
I just had a comment about my take on the broadcast industry using circular polarization. I mean, as far as I know, most TV and FM broadcast stations are using circular polarization at the transmitter site, and they do that. To reduce cross polarization losses. Most receivers, obviously receiver person with a cheap antenna is either vertical or horizontal or somewhere in between, and the transmitter has no way of knowing what the receiving person is doing. A person with TV rabbit ears could be at a 45 degree angle, not even vertical or horizontal, so the broadcaster is broadcast circular, so that way they minimize the cross polarization. If they were broadcasting just vertical and the person had a horizontal antenna, they can get like a 20 dB loss. So I don't think anybody really, the typical layperson with a TV or FM radio is going to receive with a circular type antenna. So clockwise or counterclockwise doesn't really make too much difference. They're just trying to reduce the cross polarization losses. Back over you to WJTV.
I got a couple of questions on this one, Joe, and I'm going to guess that you have some contact with the broadcast industry, either through friends or your direct involvement. My impression was, in the days of analog television, the majority of television broadcast stations were purely horizontally polarized on transmit. I know that quite a few of them experimented with circular polarization on UHF, but I think most of the VHF lower and upper VHF stations were linear polarized. Are we saying now that we've gone over to digital television, that a higher percentage have become circular, or because a higher percentage of digital television is UHF, that's another reason for circular, and the idea of using circular on transmit to favor the receiving simple antenna, rabbit ears, whatever, I've got a problem with that one, but I'll tell you that on the second transmission. But first, address this one. Was there that much circular in the early days of lower and upper VHF analog television? WJ2B, K2RIW, and the TechNet?
I'm only going by experience and what I've read. I don't really, haven't worked in that industry, but I guess Eric would be the person to talk to. But as far as I know, I know more about the FM broadcast history than I do about TV, but I know that they started off with horizontal, like what you were saying, in the early days, and then they decided to switch over to circular at some point because they were seeing, cross polarization loss between a lot of cars had vertically polarized whip antennas and a lot of home receivers, people had horizontally polarized beams, so to reduce the loss between cross polarization of say a horizontal transmitting antenna to a person in a car with a vertical whip, they went to the FCC decided to have these FM broadcast stations go to circular polarization, which I'm not even sure it's 100% circular. I know they transmit 50% of their power vertical and 50% horizontal. Whether it's actually clockwise or counterclockwise circular, I don't know. I'd have to talk to somebody with experience with FM broadcast antennas or TV broadcast antennas to say whether or not it's actually clockwise or counterclockwise. But it doesn't really matter if the person at the receiving end is just using a vertical or horizontally polarized antenna. They're not going to care if it's circular. They just know that they're not getting a cross polarization loss. So I believe that's the only reason that they went to circular. So I guess Eric would be a good person to shed some light on this WJ2D.
Yeah, let me give a quick call for Eric. KE2EJ, are you available, Eric? K2RIW?
KC2QAQ with a comment.
While we're waiting for Eric, let's see what Glenn's got to say. You got it, Glenn.
Actually, mine's more of a question. I know how circular polarization is created in a direction. In other words, like if I run a directional antenna, how to create circular polarization. But how would you do circular polarization from like an FM broadcast station in omnidirectional? That's a little confusing to me. Maybe you could say a couple of words on that one. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
There are a number of antennas that will transmit circular polarization in all compass directions. The slanted dipole array that the FM broadcast stations use on the perimeter of the observation area of the Empire State Building. QSL, I think, was one of the first ones who did that 20, 30 years ago. So it's a whole array of slanted dipoles, and they're all being fed slightly different in phase. So you've got a beam that sweeps around the horizon, and it has a moderate amount of circular polarization, or at least slant polarization to it. And do you really have to transmit circular polarization in order to favor the guy with rabbit ears and other simple kind of antennas? The reason I've got a little bit of a problem with that is what's called the chirality of the environment. Let me drop. And that is when you get a complex belt, polarization does some funny things. And you can prove this to yourself by laying a mirror flat on the table. You've got somebody on the other side of the table sitting in a chair, and you're sitting in a chair on this side of the table, and you've got a flat mirror on the table between the two. And the image you see of that person in front of you in the mirror will be upside down. Hold the mirror in your left hand way off to one side and look at the image in the mirror of that person, and the person will be reversed left to right. Hold the mirror halfway between those two. In other words, it's a little bit to your left and a little bit down, and so the mirror is now giving you, let's call it a 45 degree propagation from you toward for the person that's across the table from you. In that situation, the image you will see in the mirror of a person who's upright, the person will be horizontal in the mirror. So, as you can see, polarimetry, depending on how you do the bouncing of the signal, gets disturbed. Second of all, a clockwise signal coming from a transmitter, when it mixes with a reflected signal off the ground, if the reflected signal is strong enough and you mix it clockwise and the ground reflection does become counterclockwise primarily, and you mix the two together, you get linear. So a clockwise and a counterclockwise mix gives me a linear, and depending on the difference in path length, that linear can end up horizontal, vertical, slant 45 right, slant 45 left. So circular polarization, just to get best possible reception with simple antennas in a house, it's a rather mixed blessing. Let me drop. I will admit that in a slightly more pure environment of a pure vertical whip antenna that we used to have in the old-fashioned days on our automobile, there you would like to have a significant vertical polarization component being transmitted, because as the vehicle moves down the highway, and all of these bounce paths are going in phase and out of phase, and all kinds of things are happening in that moving vehicle environment, to have a substantial amount of transmitted polarization being co-phase with the receiving antenna's polarization, without a doubt that's an advantage. You're going to get a significantly decrease in fade rate as you move the vehicle in that case. But the real environment for fixed antennas is kind of peculiar. as you guys have heard me say so many times, let me drop. When I listen to this particular repeater, which I believe is purely vertically polarized on transmit, and I'm listening with my handy talkie in my bathroom in Huntington, I can set the handy talkie vertical on the wooden shelf, on the plastic shelf in my bathroom, and I get very poor reception. I lay the handy talkie down horizontally on that plastic shelf, and I get beautiful reception. In other words, by the time that signal gets into my bathroom in Huntington, from this repeater, the majority of the signal is horizontally polarized. So Mother Nature has done all of that switching of that signal in that 20-mile pass between there and here, if you know what I mean. So CP, I can see it doesn't cost you a huge amount of effort to do it with UHF television antennas. VHF with the so-called super fat wing antennas, if I had to make those on lower VHF, circular polarized, that would be a substantial investment in hardware at the broadcast site. That's reason, one of the reasons why I think they didn't do it. Anyone have any further comments on circular polarization for broadcast television or FM? Give me a call, let us right now. KQLIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, actually, one more question, Jeff. KQ2QIQ.
You got it, Glenn.
I really see a massive advantage to circular polarization. You know, pointing an antenna up in space into towards a satellite, and with a lot of gain in a single direction. But are there any real advantages to using a circular polarization signal across a across the horizon, across the regular normal radio horizon from a land signal? Is there anybody who really takes advantage of that? In an omnidirectional mode. I mean, you mentioned UHF television, but I was wondering if there are any specific applications. It just sounds I don't know, maybe it's just my lack of understanding in the area. It just doesn't sound like a really great idea. back over to you, K2RW, K2QIQ.
Yeah, from broadcast station to circular.
Okay.
Nowadays, most of the FM broadcast stations have become circular in order to favor moving vehicles. And in the old days, those moving vehicles had a simple whip antenna coming out of the fender of the car. Nowadays, the antenna is usually built into the windshield. It's a horizontally polarized antenna again, in many cases. So we've gone full circle here. So the vehicle started off vertical, and the broadcast station started off horizontal, and they were incompatible. The broadcasters went to either slant 45 or circular on FM broadcast. And now the resulting antennas are horizontally polarized. When it comes to satellite television, Ku-band satellite, their circular polarization is extremely important because of frequency reuse. The odd channels on satellite television, channels 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, a particular satellite, they will all be clockwise. And the even channels, 2, 4, 6, and 8, will all be counterclockwise. And the reason for that is channel 1 and channel 3, the upper frequency of channel 1 and the lowest frequency of channel 3, I better call it transponder 1, transponder 3, on synchronous satellite, those two frequencies touch each other. The upper frequency of channel 1 and the lower frequency of channel 3 touch each other. Channel 2, the one in between, overlaps half of each one of those. That's real frequency reuse. And as long as you've got clean circular polarization, with a purity of that circular polarization so that the undesired circular polarization is 25 or so dB down, clean CP on the antenna doing the reception and doing the transmitting in a space environment where there's nothing between you and that ground station but the clear blue sky, that system works like a charm. Let me drop. And I was involved in a project where one of my clients wanted to make modifications to the receiving antenna for his particular convenience, and we rapidly discovered that if you don't very carefully design the receiving antenna, the 18-inch dish on the ground, if you don't very carefully design it to get rid of the undesired circular polarization, in other words, if you're on channel number 1 and it's a clockwise channel, you want to make sure that the counterclockwise signal reception component is suppressed by, let me pick a number, 25 or 30 dB. If you don't meet that criteria, the converter will go crazy, and you don't get good reception. In fact, lots of people with satellite television reception have experienced the problem of great big rain cloud comes along, and the signal disappears. You would logically think the rain cloud created attenuation of the signal, that it interrupted the signal and attenuated it. That's not what's happening. As the raindrops get large enough, the raindrops are no longer circular, and they start creating cross-polarization coupling between the clockwise and the counterclockwise signal. So it is the polarization characteristics and the mixing characteristics of polarization of each individual raindrop being a non-spherical object, being an absorber and re-radiator, mixing those polarizations together is what usually... That's usually the major reason you get a dropout of satellite television reception during a great big rainstorm. There are people who have put up a bigger dish to make sure they've got a stronger amount of signal, and they were still getting dropouts. They had great trouble figuring out what in the world was going on. So CP with space does give them a huge advantage, but on terrestrial communication, to get that purity in the multipath environment for terrestrial communication is very, very difficult to do. Now, the most ideal system would be one which transmitted circular polarization and the receiving site had total polarization adaptability. Let me drop and explain that one. If you had enough of a steering matrix in polarization on the reception site so that even though the transmitter was pure circular, at this instant of time, depending on what Mother Nature is doing with that path between your transmitter and the receiver, you want to decide to either listen to pure horizontal, pure vertical, slant 45 right, slant 45 left, clockwise, counterclockwise, 3 dB elliptical polarization with the major axis 45 degrees to the right. If you had complete polarization adaptability on the receiver site, that kind of... what's the word I'm looking for now? Let's just call it adaptability. If you had that adaptability, you can have adaptability in range diversity, frequency diversity, and polarization diversity. If you had complete adaptability and diversity capability on reception, you could pick up a huge improvement in reception probability in the real terrestrial environment. Maybe that's what you're looking for, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
You know, it's really interesting that you're mentioning this because what you're describing is exactly what I would expect with, you know, circular polarization across the horizon. And what is interesting, though, is I'm wondering if somebody on who's actually listening might know the answer to this one, is how long ago did they make this switch? And the reason I say that is because when I was living in Florida, I grew up here in the New York area, Long Island area, and years ago, I always used to have FM radios inside the house without external antennas, and I could pretty much tune in almost everything without an outside antenna on FM. But I realized when I moved back to New York sometime in close to 2000, I came back here again, I noticed that in order to get really any kind of decent FM reception, I had to put an antenna outdoors. And I was surprised that once I had a really good high-mounted FM antenna, I could get all the stations I used to get with just a simple receiver, like a little Bose radio sitting inside the house. Now I need an external one. And I'm wondering, was that about somewhere in the area of like 10 or 15 years ago that they switched over to the circular polarization? That would explain a lot. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, K2QIQ.
WSYQ. Okay, I'm going to pass it to Paul and then Joe in that order, WJ2B, who maybe knows something about this. WS2N, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, Dick, don't you remember many, many years ago, if you listen to, I think it was when the TV stations went off the air, well, it might have been radio, like what Glenn's saying, but they used to make an announcement, you know, this station, whatever it might be, you know, transmitting at, you know, a certain amount of wattage. They always said that they were, you know, where they were transmitting from might be Empire State Building. And they always said that we're transmitting using vertical and horizontal antennas. They say vertical and horizontal polarization. I seem to remember that. I don't know if you you remember that. You know, you might have to be up like 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning when stations used to go off the air. And then all of a sudden you'd see a black and white icon sitting on a TV or Channel 2 in a high-pitched tone. Back you there.
Okay, Dick.
I know. The slant 45-degree polarization dipole-like things that are on the perimeter of the observation deck, the upper levels, I think it's 102nd floor of Empire State Building, and I think that array was made by the Alfred Company, gave them this slant 45, and because of the phasing relationship and the way they feed all those individual elements, I believe they got at least elliptical polarization, if not circular. When it comes to circular polarization that goes out in all directions on the horizon, which was one of Glenn's earlier questions, if you simply Google the word Lindenblatt array, L-I-N-D-E-N-B-L-A-T, that's phonetically, that may not be the correct pronunciation, spelling, but Lindenblatt array, you Google those words or look up the appropriate chapter on circular polarization in the antenna engineering handbook, you'll find that there is a design of an antenna. And there's a number of them, though, that can transmit circular polarization. Rather clean circular, all compass headings on the horizon. At first, that seems like it's opposite of common sense. You would think on a spherical relationship, you'd only be able to transmit pure circular polarization when the signal is coming out of the North Pole or out of the South Pole of the sphere. But there are other kinds of antennas that can do it. QXR, a number of people who used to listen to them and some of the other stations, because they became relocated and changed the power output, that's another factor. And the house you came back to maybe wasn't the exact same location as the one that you left, if you know what I mean, Glenn. So a lot of things are going on here. There's a lot of variables involved, and you're getting more difficult reception with an indoor antenna as you move back from Florida. I'm dropping. But I know we passed 9 o'clock. Let me go over to Mel's mailbag. We've got in the wings waiting Lou, NY2H, and also Paul. Mel, K2KEY, what kind of burning questions did we get today, other than the fact we got some flack because we don't wait long enough for people to sign in? You got it, Mel.
K2KEY, we get some flack that we didn't get the email and on any kind of time schedule. All right, well, whatever. Well, I get one here, Dick, and I don't know. I guess maybe my situation and all is making it a little more difficult for me to deal with it, but I get a few here that, you know, I don't know how to answer them, really. I sympathize. I try to bang out, you know, some answers to some people because, you know, they don't be able to get in here many times. But occasionally I get one, believe it or not, I got two here that I just cannot come up with any kind of reasonable answer. They are somewhat strange. I don't know how much you want to get in depth with this, Dick. Over.
Well, right now I don't know the subject matter, so give it a try, Mel. And it's not going to catch on fire. Nobody's going to die. Let's give it a college try, Mel. Go ahead.
It's nothing obscene or anything. It's just no sense involved. Here's one. Please, please, please. And it goes on about six times. I've asked you this many times. You're about my last hope. I purchased recently a fairly new transceiver. I also purchased an antenna from a commercial that makes commercial dipoles that is advertised in the magazine, comes with the coax and all. I hooked it up to the transmitter, and the transmitter light comes on at the SWR speed. It just doesn't want to work at all. I then thought that maybe they suggested that I need a tuner. I purchased the tuner. Listen to this carefully, okay? I purchased the tuner, not a cheap one, a fairly, but considered fairly decent tuner. I still have had no results in getting this rig to work. All right, let me let it drop because you got to listen carefully to this one. I finally was able to coach some locals
and it's hard sometimes to get help when you need it, you know. He brought over a handheld antenna analyzer and said there is absolutely nothing wrong with my antenna.